So yeah, this is, of course, a discussion. So more than one person can participate in that discussion besides me. So I wanted to, so as one thinks sort of about the big picture of accretion disk theory, as I do a bit, I was thinking, what would one want in a 22nd century textbook accretion theory? So there's lots of work, of course, in individual objects and individual classes of objects. But what is the, you know, a synthesis of that that would appear ultimately in textbook? So one analog to that, of course, is stellar evolution. If one looks, for example, at the classic book by Shu, which is the physical universe, there's a beautiful summary chapter of stellar evolution in that book that can be explained across the full range of masses and luminosities and radii. So what is the sort of analog? What would we want in that picture for accretion disk? So one we have, of course, Shakura-Sanayev is the workhorse model that is the closest to something that's universal in this respect. And we've had lots of simulations of transport, for example, in accretion disks. But it seems that there is some lack of feedback between the output of the simulations and input into revising the standard mean field accretion disk model. I'll explain that concept in a moment. But the Shakura-Sanayev model is the workhorse model. The viscosity that enters into that hasn't really been updated in terms of the physical characteristic of that viscosity as a result of sort of, say, MRI simulations, for example. I mean, we know that transport is complicated, but what you know, how do we update that theory? So I see that as kind of a grand challenge of accretion disk theory to have a mean field, have a theory that is that is has includes more physics but is still tractable. And so maybe we can and so what is in part why do I say that this is a mean field theory? One thing, and this may be obvious to many with experience, but for those often working with accretion disks as a tool for characterizing observations, this might not always be clear why this is the case. So, I mean, one so the fact that it's a mean field theory follows from this fact alone that, you know, turbulence is not axisymmetric. So if you believe that alpha represents a turbulent viscosity and you use a R-dependent accretion model that depends only on R, then there's an averaging procedure hidden in that approach straight away. So this implies that it is a mean field theory. So then the question is, what approximations have been made to come up with the mean field theory that one is using in a kind of alpha prescription? And that has to do with, of course, approximating the stress. Now, let me just try this here. Maybe we don't need even the screen. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that's good. I can leave it up, because then if you can see that, that's...
Okay.
Can't see it, okay. I just was going to say, so this is... So this is just a showing what the approximation is for the mean standard mean field theory.
Not
good.
And there is the stick.
Good, okay, stick. So, go old school here. So the mean field approximation comes in the stress, the transport for angular momentum, and I would just so the and the you know the flux the r phi component of the flux of angular momentum. this is the flux of angular momentum, and this is the these are the radial and this is the vertical components. And if you do a mean field model, typically the idea is you break quantities up into mean flow and fluctuations. And if you interpret the Shakura-Tsunayev model in terms of a mean field theory, I would just want to point out that you basically throw away most all of the stress terms that contribute in principle to angular momentum transport. So in the Shakura-Tsunayev approach, the combination, or really the velocity component, VR, V phi, is replaced. Actually, this combination, I have this dotted out because typically the magnetic contribution, so this is the Alphain speed, the magnetic contribution to the stress is sort of mixed up in here and assumed that it all contributes to a kind of isotropic turbulence. And in that approach, the stress is given by the standard form, and your alpha viscosity comes here. So this combination is replaced by the alpha viscosity. But I call your attention to the fact that all of these other terms are thrown away. So the mean field model drops, you know, any component associated with, well, it keeps this as the radial mean inflow, but here's a contribution from large-scale magnetic fields, and it ignores all the vertical transport terms as well. So in principle, this is just a sort of a grand, this I think highlights that there is opportunity between just keeping this and working with some of the extra terms down the road. In particular, this is now a large-scale transport component. the essence, you know, large-scale versus viscous transport, you might say that you can always approximate everything with an alpha, but the physics of large-scale transport is different from the physics of a local viscosity. I should note that typically many people, for practical purposes, just think of the viscosity as being, you just take the Navier-Stokes equation and then you replace it with instead of a microphysical viscosity, you replace it with this turbulent viscosity. But that, of course, as I said before, that requires, if you then assume those equations are axisymmetric, you can't really do that. You're folding under the rug an averaging procedure in that process. So this.
Well, this is supposed to be justified by the fact that H over R
is small. Yeah.
Strictly speaking, it is small.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you could imagine, you know, starting with this and saying, okay, I'm going to make another approximation. You know, the simplest way of sort of fussing with that would be to just add another alpha, different alphas. But that's not entirely the end of what you would want to do either. You'd like some principles that dictate, what gets transported by the radial transport, how much of the transport is radial, how much is going into the corona. What is the large scale? What dictates those fractions? What are the principles that dictate those fractions? So that therein lies the sort of physical thinking and trying to come up with a better model. So you can, just sort of kludgy put in parameters and then twiddle them around. And that comes back to a related point. So let me just go with this this plot here. So, I mean, typically, the way we think about modeling such a spectra is to take some disk component, take some coronal component, take some jet component, and patch them together, but not a theory that actually can, in general, predict what fraction, when you get a thermal component, when you get a a coronal component, when you get a kind of jet component, there's something needed in that, which I think is also tied in with what I was saying with the mean field theory. Can you make a dynamical prediction, say just as a function of the accretion rate, what the subsequent transport is via small scale, large scale, and then convert those into these sorts of components. So that's one point. Now, I was one related concept. So about this 22nd century textbook theory also is that never mind the title, that was one of them, but just look at the this is of course the HR diagram, and I think one target in this long-term thing would be to have the analog of an HR diagram that you could put all accretion disks on somehow. Would that be the closest thing it seems that we have right now is the maybe luminosity versus hardness that we've seen discussed a number of times. Maybe those aren't the only variables. Maybe one also has the variability or some other. But what are the minimum set of things that you would want to put on the summary diagram of something like the HR diagram? So that's another thought that is in this concept of this what would be in the 22nd century technical. So those are all sort of coupled together, because if you sort of had some kind of mean field model, you might be able to sort of put it. So this is, see, 22nd century, that's a long time away. So you can see that this is quite a challenge, a grand challenge, not going to be resolved here. Okay, so now I wanted to then talk a little bit about, so let me pull this back off, what the, some of the, yeah. So why, so as you noticed, one of the terms there was this large scale. So why would one be interested in large scale transport? So I'm sort of thinking of this standard viscosity as representing a reasonable, say, approximation for small scale transport or turbulent transport. But why large scale? Why worry about this in a sort of complete theory? Well, obviously there are jets. We observe jets. And also, I would argue, corona. So those are both phenomena that involve likely dissipation and transport away from the disk itself. So, and a natural way, for example, of corona is to imagine that you have magnetic fields that are, say, amplified in the disk and buoyantly somehow make their way or are torqued in some way that produce structures in the corona. So dissipation then occurs in the corona. But that requires something like a condition that structures that you make in the disk are buoyantly rise, for example, to the corona on a shorter time scale, then they're shredded by various turbulence in the disk. And that leads to a characteristic minimum scale, because the buoyancy time just goes as 1 power of the buoyancy time is some L over buoyancy, could be, and the diffusion time goes as L squared. You work this out, you can get an approximate condition on structures of the scale. You have to make an approximation for this, but there is some statement about buoyancy. If the buoyancy is lower than shorter than the diffusion time, that has maybe also something to do with logic. Certainly jets. Now, so
maybe yeah. Winds go in that category.
And winds, yes, I have winds as well.
Has anyone ever checked that, the sort of scales that you get in the
Schering
box or even the global simulation?
So that's part of what I was going to say, yeah. Oh, okay. And so the question, right. So now I was going to say, so in the theme of why large scale fields, so we could also describe this as sort of evidence. Or large-scale transport, at least. And now, what about evidence from, say, simulations, for example. So here, so the, historically, I would say there is a sociological component to the study of turbulence in disks. When the Shakura-Sanayev arguments for the importance of turbulence, of course, when one would seeking what is the source of turbulence, the study of the MRI, for example, has been a breakthrough in that regard. However, the assumption that the transport is turbulent combined with the limitations of computational power has focused energy on the shearing boxes, which is a workhorse tool. It has become an enterprise in and of itself. It is a subfield of applied math at this point and applied physics, which has, you know, predicting things of what's going on in shearing box or other idealized MHD simulations. I regard them almost as its own self justified subfield, it sort of separately from whether it's actually the connection to the observation. So, I mean, I would take that diplomatic route. There, one can criticize whether the boundary conditions and such are appropriate, but I think it is its subfield, and there's lots you can learn. If you can make a prediction for something that happens in a shearing box, then it means that you understand the MHD equations. And if you're using the MHD equations to apply to nature, then that's a kind of a intermediate practical tool. So not to be too critical of the shearing boxes, but they are meant to be a local region of a disk, and are in thus. Well, that's just have some intrinsic limitation as to. But you can even ask in the shearing boxes, is there evident? So what is it? You know, what is the transport like? What is the scale? In shearing boxes. I guess that's one way of saying it. So, I mean, the box itself is supposed to be some localized region. But if it's the case that the... But in fact, you know, what you see in the shearing box... So let's say the transport... Let's say a shearing box were large enough to capture the scale of transport such that it really were a microphysical, such that it really were a viscosity. You might expect that in the shearing box, then you might see a peak in the stress on some scale in the box so that you've made your box big enough, and then you've captured that scale. And then you could say that the characteristic scale of transport is captured in the box, and it's below this characteristic scale as a function of some scale. But it typically, in the shearing boxes, you see transport that actually is quite large on the dominated by the first few modes of the box, usually. So, I mean, the stresses go all the way to the box scale. And if you make the boxes larger, the stresses go up to the larger scale of the box.
So this is where I want Jake to chime in, because he has done these experiments, and what you're saying is true, but only in part. There does seem to be a scale. I mean, there's a correlation line that you've discovered that is finite,
right?
But there's also an extended. Can you comment?
So I mean, there does seem to be a sort of a saturation of small scale stuff. So if you do a correlation length analysis, that
for the energy
large enough, it will sort of converge. But there is always a large scale problem, I think, what you're
I mean, there is a question of what the relative strength of these are.
Right.
And one example of that is let's see if I have this. So, I mean, we did some analysis of the stress spectra. And for what it's worth, this is not so much to be like different results in different simulations, but I can. This is 50% of the stress was in this simulation. So this is a isothermal stratified X shear periodic 4x4x8, 48 zones. Not very big, but it's stratified. And we found that sort of the Maxwell stress was dominated by the largest. So there's an issue, very subtle issue, about what one means by actually large scale. But for the moment, just think of this as these are modes. This end of the mode is the larger scale. This is the smaller scale. So like 50%, so 50% of the stress was here dominated by like the first few modes in this case. But even more, so that's kind of the message here. This is 50% in this sort of case for the Maxwell stress, which dominates the stress.
So is that consistent with what you were finding? I thought it was smaller.
I was just about to let
you see it. Are you doing correlation functions of the fields themselves?
Yes, and so I'm not sure if one can necessarily
stress or
are different things, right? So the worry is I'm not sure if I actually looked at the strength of the stress compared to the small to the large scale. I was looking at the convergence of them as you make the bonds.
I think that is a good point. So stress is interesting. So the other thing that's more dramatic than maybe the total box average is the vertical distribution of this. So this is showing the contribution sort of at the top and the bottom. When it gets towards the corona, it's totally dominated by the larger scale, whereas in the middle, it's less. So this was the ratio. This is basically the ratio, but the red is the large scale. So this is stratified. This is evidence that at least in the corona, by that time, you're seeing sort of more larger scale.
These are isothermal simulations?
Stratified, but isothermal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The boundary conditions are what?
Periodic in every, so periodic in vertical and shear periodic in radius. And
you
as
a periodic in vertical.
I am definitely of the school that this is a toy thing. The boundary conditions in terms of making this, so you know what you interpret from this with respect to observations is very, the boundary conditions I don't think are physical. I don't like vertical periodic boundary conditions from physical point of view. But it's also true in...
I think you get this very
same
similar
thing, yeah.
Result without flow boundaries.
Yeah, yeah, if you're vertical field boundaries.
Generally
as
periodic
well.
Boundaries in the vertical direction, as fake as they are, don't change too much.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. But I agree that they're not...
In global calculations, so Mario did some experiment with 45 degree wedges mm-hmm. and then all the way to 360. And the stress increased as the wedge size increased.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's another thing. So I think in what I've seen of the global as well, whether the global have converged or not is probably not.
That is the question exactly. So can you describe this a little bit? So what was the geometry? It was a wedge?
So global spherical coordinates, I think. Yeah. Big wedges from 30 or 45 degrees all the way.
In theta, you're talking about.
In
phi.
And phi. And you have to have at least 380 degrees to have the stress converge on the 360 degree boundary.
Oh no, that's totally okay.
But
do you also
expect it from the vertical structures compared with isothermal simulations and a simulation with a superconsistent thermodynamics?
Yeah, I think it could be, but of course the field, you know, if the principles of buoyancy are still operating, you would still, expect. You'd still expect the same principles to apply. If the field is large and if the field is able to, buoyantly rise up, those principles wouldn't change.
Right, by me showing that I got quantitative.
Quantitatively, yes, exactly. Yeah. But you know, if we say, for example, that even if this number is 20%, say, of stress is occurring in the cone or something, you can then say, okay, if you take an astrophysical object such as an AGN, and you make a toy estimate and you say that the coronal emission is coming from some fraction of the stress that was transported to the corona, that number may depend on may depend on certain things which haven't been quite identified yet, but agreed. So there's some distribution. It may only be 10%, maybe 20% in some cases, it may be 40%. Exactly how that depends on the thermodynamics and the limits of which, you know, what's going on is a bit, I mean, so that's out there. But I agree. I think that you're not guaranteed the same quantitative.
Not a comment on that, but what you were saying before with the larger scales, I just looked up that 2012 paper I did. And yes, it looks like the fraction of the magnetic energy always seems to be at the larger scale, even if you make the box bigger. Even though there's this convergence of small scale, like there's always a small scale component, but it gets weaker relative to the large scale component. And this is related to the weird fact that if you make the box larger, the variability, the temporal variability goes down and down, and it becomes more driven by the dynamo. So at the largest box, we just found this dynamo flip, you know, this dynamo was basically what was controlling
the stress.
It was all large scale.
Yeah.
And if you look at the alpha curve, it goes whoop, whoop, whoop like that due to the dynamo flipping.
So, that's a good point. So another point is that the stress, and there. Others have found that, there's a couple of points in what you're saying to build on. So he's talking about a cycle period. If you take the planar averaged large-scale field, and I think you typically would average over X, Y, in the box, that's the typical averaging, which is radial and azimuthal, so horizontal averaging, leaving quantities as a function of Earth. There's a mean field that emerges in the quasi-steady state that has a cycle period of order 10 orbits or so, a large-scale field. And the stress is found to correlate with the cycle period. So as that cycle period changes, it doesn't necessarily even mean in all cases that the stress is dominated by those fields, but the stress does correlate with the large scale. The total stress does correlate with those large scale dynamo cycles, in the reversal of that large scale field, quote large scale, really system scale. But that is another piece of evidence that. Argument that the large scales of the system are influential in either controlling or reflecting what's going on in the stress dynamics.
Isn't that the equivalent of saying that the MRI operating in the azimuth direction of the azimuth field generates a strength which is proportional to the wind field strength in the azimuth direction? Essentially what you're saying is there's a dynamo operation which creates a flip in the azimuthal field, which increases in amplitude and then decreases, but it seems inevitable to me that the MRI will respond to that by generating stresses which proportional to the field in the azimuthal direction.
That's right, except...
So in what sense are we talking about large scales, and in what sense are we talking about the strength of the MRI in response to the mean field in the box?
Excellent question. I would say a slightly different point. It is right. So the MRI. So here's sort of maybe a provocative statement. The MRI itself, large scale fields are produced directly from the MRI instability, and so what I mean by that ties into. I can let's see. Let me just. Lights, I guess.
I just put the lights on.
Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, sorry, that's. I got myself confused there, yeah. Excellent. So, first of all, what is really do we mean by a large-scale field? This is actually very important in really distilling the literature and the physics on this subject. So typically, in the shearing boxes, when people talk about a large-scale field, the shearing box, it really means a planar averaged field with one component left over. And that's a, so it, for example, it might be B of just Z averaged over X and Y. So you could, you know, something like that. And so this actually, why I say this is a subtle point is just that it can have strong variations in Z. So such a field could reverse, you know, could reverse in Z on a relatively small scale, but it's averaged over two of the dimensions of the box. And you might think in sort of in traditional dynamo theory that that is something in between a small scale and a large scale field. In typical, for example, galactic and stellar dynamos, one often, well, it depends. The averaging procedure is a whole story in and of itself. It's actually quite subtle what choice of averages that are appropriate for a physical system. Typically, you want some sort of scale separation where there's a natural large scale and there's lots of fluctuations on small scale. This kind of thing in these boxes can leave large gradients in the vertical direction. But one thing that we looked at, and this is with Fatima Ibrahimi Pahlavi Bhatt, both at Princeton, is the early time growth of the MRI. So if you take both analytically quasi-linear theory, but also in simulations, if you look at the early time in the MRI, do the large-scale fields lead the small-scale fields, or do the small-scale fields lead the large-scale fields? Typically, when we think of dynamos in the sun or galaxy, you start with turbulent forcing, and you ask, how does that produce a sort of large-scale field? If the MRI were to grow these large-scale fields directly, then you would expect before the system becomes unstable to turbulence to see evidence for the large-scale fields, and indeed we do. So what one finds is that the key is that you have to start with non-axisymmetric perturbations, and then the MRI so the minimum ingredients is what we were looking at, what minimum ingredients you need to make a planar average large scale field. And by the way, I should say that there are two, let me just finish that thought and I'll come back to this. So the large-scale field does grow immediately from the linear modes of the MRI. And then the system becomes turbulent and the higher modes fill in later on. So you get, you know, growth. There are low modes that grow, single, you know, relatively low. I mean, low modes grow below the scale of the maximally growing mode before you get all kinds of nonlinear turbulence. I'll show that in a moment. One other point, though, I wanted to make is that Fatima Ibrahimi, who is the collaborator on looking at this evolution of these early large-scale field growths in simulation, so she comes from a plasma physics community where the standard codes are cylindrical because of tokamaks and such, not shear P periodic boundaries. So in those, in the calculations with her, she has a code that looked at the evolution not in in the planar, not in the horizontal averaging, but in vertical averaging. So quantities being a function of radius. And so we worked out the equations in that case, and also the case where you average in the other plane, average in horizontal and vertical. So why I say that's interesting is because that itself is important. What is your averaging procedure? If you average in one, if you average in one direction, one plane, you get a different set of electromotive force components than if you average in the other plane. So your interpretation of what the dynamo is involves a different set of terms. In one case, the traditional, what it's called the omega effect, the linear shear, is playing a role. In the other case, it isn't. So that's important. So in the two different cases, both show a growth logical field. Now let me see if I can just identify a just a quick example of this. Sorry. Missing this particular, let me just see here, sorry. Somehow I'm missing a particular plot, but let me, I can draw instead what the point is. So we, example of this is that if you basically plot, so as a function of time, what you see, if you look at either planar averaged, either the b of z squared and or b of x squared, these are two different averages. This is the horizontal average, this is the vertical average. But you can plot those, and what you find is that as the magnetic energy, so there's a kind of a, those grow. And then the thing becomes rapidly, so this is b squared. And early on, you'll find that these two averages this kind of thing grow. This is about 20 orbit time scales where the thing starts to saturate. But you see this early growth in these large scale components really straight away from the simulation. And as the simulation proceeds, those are sustained. And if you watch the spectra, so you can plot the observed evolution of the kind of magnetic spectra, and what you see is something like, as a function of time, you see the field, it does something like this. So it starts sort of like this, and then keeps growing and eventually sort of fills out like this. So early times, you have a sort of peak near the maximally growing wave mode of the MRI. So if you take a vertical field, you're going to grow at some kVa is equal to omega. This component is growing right from the early end, and then eventually you kind of get this sort of structure that fills out maybe overall with peak magnetic energy. But right from the get-go, you're seeing growth of the very small-scale modes. And in fact, the turnover here, I guess, is also like lower. So this turnover, as a function of time, this is E magnetic of K, this is K, you see that the spectrum fills out to larger K with time. The early low Ks are growing early on. So the message of this, and one can look in more details at the paper, but the message of this is that you could argue that the MRI large, by the definition that one uses by a planar average, large-scale field growth actually is sort of leading the subsequent, I mean, it's happening early on, or even before the turbulence develops. So you don't need the turbulence, you don't need to, I mean, there's a second, in the, when the turbulence develops, you see something else. You see the cycle periods, that this, the large-scale field now incurs these cycle periods. And that's fully in the nonlinear regime. But early on, you're seeing the non-steady growth of the large-scale fields really sort of right away, large-scale defined again by the...
I'm a little confused by that plot, though, because it's just the smaller scales develop first, right?
Intermediate scales. This is okay. Like
so
the maximally growing.
Where's the KVA equals maximum?
Here.
Yeah. So that's the fastest growing?
That does grow the
fastest.
Yeah, okay. It does, yeah.
But you said that the...
But it's just that it fills out to the right as well, whereas the low modes are also growing. These are not growing as fast, but they're also growing.
Okay, but you said that the low modes are leading the...
Well, I mean that in the sense that all of this, yeah, is not here when this is growing. So
oh,
it's, that's all.
So the left grows up.
You don't require the...
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I see.
Exactly. So, yeah. Now...
You do require that KD and the maximum growing yeah. Belt, it seems. That's still the thing. It is a linear scale.
That is, yeah, exactly. Now...
The large scale modes just unstable in your ears. Is this, are they growing faster than station?
I think
I
no.
Mean,
I think
they're, really the
yeah, they're growing consistent. I mean, they are growing consistently with what they should.
So it's all linear then.
In that regime.
Yeah.
Okay. Really time sheet. Eventually, it's not. But
yeah, and just to be clear, in that left hand plot, you really are plotting b bar squared.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
B squared bar.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this is nonlinear interactions. It's not modes because they would just average to zero.
Right. That's
you're getting a sense of you're getting an overall polarity developing.
Get a new feel.
Yeah. Now,
I wanted to understand a bit. What does it mean to develop a large scale field from the linear MRI?
So these,
if we started with disordered field colloidal initially, if the seed field was completely disordered, we wouldn't have got the large scale fields.
You're saying that the if you start with a completely disordered field, so we don't start with a completely
disordered field. So if I start with completely disordered colloidal field, completely disordered, like
colloidal.
No large scale colloidal field at all, completely random variations of the colloidal. Would it still get a large scale mean B5?
When you say completely random vertical field, I would say if you, you know, like a slightly less random would be zero net flux, but there's a question of how, what you put the interval for the zero net flux if you make that very, very small. I think you would then still see the effect, but the fields would reverse. The toroidal field would reverse over much smaller scales, so you would still get, you'd still see an effect, so it's sort of a local. I mean, so because you're only averaging in the plane, you would see that, but it would be.
So at every point, I will have my own field.
Right. Okay. So by certain definition, that would be a large. Yeah. That leads to me. So now, So it is important to note that, you know, the different averaging procedures play a role here. But one thing I would say is that, to some extent, the role of this, you know, just if one takes it in general terms, the role of a large-scale field, you see the averaging procedure. And we also talked about the averaging procedure that accretion disk theory has to itself be a mean field theory.
Can I ask you a follow-up, a dumb follow-up? So on the right plot, when we go from early times to late times when we saturate, this presumes that the initial colloidal field is large scale.
Or zero net flux, but with some wave mode we used like
comparable to the box size.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I had a completely random colloidal field,
then
I wouldn't have gotten large scale.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
I mean, I do think that. So one of the things is that I'm trying to think. So we've identified in the amplification of this the actual terms in the EMF that grow the field. But related to your question, I'm trying to understand the physical motion and stretching of the actual field lines, what they look like to make the resultant large-scale field. And I sort of think that if one makes the field more and more random, you might still see the similar effect, but like on the local field lines. And the same stretching would be occurring in sort of a very local region, and it wouldn't maybe not translate to the same mean field depending on how you average, but getting a sense of how the field lines are actually being stretched as a function of the scale of the input variation of the initial field is kind of an interesting direction to try to really understand the physics of how the stresses.
I'm a little confused. Which case does this apply to? Like, it's zero net flux, but still relatively large-scale field?
Actually, it applies to both. In the two cases we did, the zero net flux was like two reversals across the box. And also it applies to the net flux.
But if you have, like, something.
If you do something like this, if you make it very, very random, then I think, if you make that scale extremely small, there's going to be some kind of probably diffusion and mixing, and you would lose the effect eventually. So I don't know exactly what this wave number would be of the initial field that you have to start to make the effect go away. I do think of it as happening in sectors. You know, there's a sector, even though the field is reversing, the fact that there is a sort of, you know, a sizable fraction of the box has this initial flux is important. If you make that really, really tiny, you would get mixing, and eventually that should go away. So, I mean, that there is a scale, I believe, at which you would put in the reversal, and it would probably go away, so I agree. Now, just if we just, the big picture here, coming back to the big picture again, I mentioned that the accretion disk theory is a mean field theory, and I'm arguing that even in the MRI simulation, so in some ways you think of the fact that I was sort of thinking in my mind that by talking about the MRI simulations and saying that there are large-scale fields appearing even there, it's sort of saying, okay, if you're getting large, it's saying that, and if you go to global simulations that were mentioned, the message continues. That is, the large-scale fields seem to appear on the global scale, large scale. The larger you make the boxes, you still get large-scale structures. There always seems to be stress at the largest scale, if not dominating. I don't know, I mean, I think convergence of the global simulations is a question, but the trend seems to be that direction. So those two things, and of course nature has corona and jets, so all of those things combined suggest that the role of large-scale fields, and I think the most subtle case is the shearing box, but it's present even there. So now we come back to sort of the concept of the mean field theory and what we would want sort of in the 22nd century. So what I would argue, of course, is that mean field electrodynamics should be coupled to the mean field accretion theory. I mean, so they're really two components of the same thing. And it's sort of a yin-yang at present, because the people who study the large-scale field growth in dynamos assume that the velocity flows are steady as a background flow, typically, and the profile is established. People who study, you know, the accretion evolution of the accretion flow and the accretion rate assume that the magnetic field is sort of going along for the ride, and the dynamics of the large-scale field in particular are not coupled into the theory. So I would say that the mean field theory that one would like to see ultimately would be one that actually couples the dynamical evolution of the large-scale fields to the accretion flow. So that's a kind of, the full theory would be track both of those, components. So there'd be a dynamical coupling between the large scale and so really in the context of disks, the mean field dynamo theory and the accretion theory are just one theory. It's not two separate theories. Now, there's a couple principles about the large scale field evolution as to why I would say that dynamos are important and what principles sort of dictate some of the presence of a large scale field. I mean, one challenge that's active and folks in this room, including Juno over there, trying to understand, what are the minimum conditions that you need to generate a large-scale field where a large-scale field has to have a specific definition. And this, say, in the case of an MRI, it would be, say, a Schering box. But if you think, say, what are the minimum ingredients that you need to generate a large-scale field, that's a question because, and by large scale, I mean if you have some set of fluctuations, to have a field survive averaging over at least two dimensions requires something to survive over those fluctuations. So what, sort of what principles dictate that? And another question relates to this is what about, and they're actually very coupled, what about just the advection of fields, large-scale fields, into a turbulent, in a turbulent system? So the reason I often think about, reason I think amplification is important, so amplification and diffusion are themselves part of the same electrodynamics, mean field electrodynamics, because transport is, diffusion is just one of the transport coefficients. There are other transport coefficients that can grow the field. But one sort of general message that makes the focus on amplification important is that I think, I would make a bold statement that flux is really not frozen. In turbulent MHD, so I should say mean. Now, what I mean essentially by this is that if you write the equations of some mean field, let's not worry so much about specifying the average, the meaning of the average, but just note that there's some large scale and there's some small scale. We just might say that B is equal to B plus B bar, so that and the when you do kind of these mean field formalisms, this electromotive force is something like the analog of the stress in the Navier-Stokes equations. It has to be approximated. In the typical theory, you approximate this by some quantity that's dependent on B bar. And there are various ways of doing this, but one common, if you expand, you can find all the terms actually mathematically, linear, quadratic, et cetera, et cetera. But let's take these two terms to lowest order, to its first order and its gradient, plus there could be higher quantities that depend on second derivatives and such. So if this is dependent linearly on the field, then you have these coefficients to worry about. Now, but the point is that this coefficient is like a turbulent diffusion. If you calculate it, it is basically like a turbulent diffusion. And so the flux, what you normally think of as flux freezing, applies to laminar magnetic fields that have a scale of variation that's much larger than the scale of the microphysical viscous or microscopical resistivity can operate. Resistivity is very small, so you need a very tiny scale for the resistivity to have an influence, typically. But when you have macroscopic motions, a diffusion term in the flux becomes very important. And so it's not just, and in fact, the diffusion is a macroscopic diffusion. And then all of your arguments about, you know, this term, this basically makes this term, gives you an effective diffusion coefficient for the mean field, which is, you know, so you might have plus a term that's a diffusion term, beta turbulent, in addition to the very small magnetic diffusivity. So the flux freezing now has to apply to this contribution if you were expecting flux freezing at all. And it just, in general, this term is quite large. So you know there's a classic argument by Luboff and Pringle for accretion disks that if you compare, for example, if you replace this diffusion coefficient by the same alpha viscosity, approximately, this term in an accretion disk that's thin picks up the vertical gradient scale 1 over h squared. And the advection term, which comes from this, I left off the advection term here, so plus the mean. And this term has a contribution that goes as VR, say BZ, start with a vertical field, something like that. The VR is an accretion velocity. This gradient picks up a radial scale. And when you take the ratio of the diffusion term to the advection term, you find that the diffusion term wins. So the field, there's an argument that the diffusion term is larger than the advection term.
But this specifically depends on the scale height of the disk.
So right, so a very thin disk, if for a thick disk, the ratio goes to 1.
Right.
So the point is that, and that's a general, so this general problem of advecting flux, if you're thing is turbulent, is rather generic. If your disk is not turbulent and laminar, then you have no problem advecting flux, and you can derive a self-consistent solution with just large-scale fields alone, like Conigal, for example, and Blanford Payne, which in fact was originally studied as an angular-momentum transport. It's used often as sort of as a jet model, but it's self-consistently operates as angular-momentum transport. So that is. That is a key problem, and that's why. So a lot of the effort in dynamo theory is understanding not maybe just this term, so other coefficients besides the diffusion term that come out naturally in the flow are sources of potential growth, and inevitably. So that's one principle. And let me just say just a few more things about what you would expect to be underlying perhaps some of the growth one way or another. So if you ask, you know, what principles, so this term is sort of a classic growth term for dynamos, and depending on, and this, you can see two points that emerge there. One is that, so if you think that there's a term that's proportional, that the electromotive force has a term that's proportional to the magnetic field, then E dot B associated with the mean field is not zero. Now this E dot B is a source of magnetic helicity, something called magnetic helicity. Magnetic helicity is a measure of link and twist, linkage and twist of magnetic field lines. And it's a quantity that is conserved in magnetohydrodynamics. So the linkage of field lines is a conserved quantity in MHD, and it's better conserved than magnetic energy is. And the reason for that, so there's two key principles about magnetic helicity which I leave you with. So basically the equation for magneticity, which is the vector potential dotted into the magnetic field, has a dissipation term that depends on the dot product of the current and the magnetic field, whereas the magnetic energy dissipation term goes as del squared of B dotted with B. So this thing is going as a B squared over a length scale, and this thing is going as B squared over two length scales. So as the scales get smaller and smaller, the dissipation scale gets smaller and smaller, this thing is preferentially decaying compared to this. The other point is that the magnetic helicity is basically, so K dot A dot B has units of energy, where K is some wave number, or you could say over some length scale. And so you can see that if magnetic helicity is conserved, if the twist and linkage is conserved, the larger the scale that the helicity resides at, the lower the total magnetic energy. So if you generally believe the principle that that there's a sort of relaxation, that it goes in the direction that if you want large-scale fields, it is helpful to have helical. It's helpful to have some helical component in there playing a role, just because of this very fact that helical fields like to reside on the scale of largest of systems. So, and typically, when you have a purely magnetically dominated system, which is the case maybe in coronae, but not actually in the disk, but coronae, where the magnetic field starts to dominate, that is similar to laboratory plasmas at low, where the magnetic energy dominates the, so fusion plasmas, magnetic energy dominates the thermal energy. And the study of relaxation of plasmas has been studied at length in that context. And an underlying principle is that helical magnetic fields relax to the largest scale available to them, subject to the boundary conditions available. So that relaxation process, so the disk, so the dynamo case still involves some component of helicity. The corona is even more like the laboratory plasma, in the sense that the coronas are likely low plasma beta, so the system will relax. So you might expect this relaxation process, I mean, as you do, to occur. So in corona in general, large-scale fields, a natural reason for expecting them is that for expecting helical fields to relax to large-scale fields is based on sort of these basic concepts. Now, I'm not sure how much longer to go, but
we should probably wrap it up
yeah.
fairly soon.
So,
although we haven't heard about planetary nebulae.
Yeah, so that maybe that's one thing I was thinking I could just jump right to, change complete gears if you would like, and we that makes sense to do that, and let me do that. Okay, so I'll just do that quickly.
So everyone is going to be shocked that planetary nebulae have anything to do with accretion disks.
Yes. Yeah, this is sort of really a new paragraph here. I am not, this is going to have a different flavor, if that's okay, and a different community will perhaps be. The basic point about planetary nebulae, and so what do they have to do with accretion disks? Right. Actually, it's an interesting, another interesting sociological point. I believe that, so planetary nebulae are now known to have jets, and this is really the result of the Hubble Space Telescope in the 90s. Before that, I think our grandmother's planetary nebula looked like this. And because the resolution wasn't good enough to see this, the small scales, the you just didn't see the dramatic asphericity. So I have a theory that because the asphericity was only recently, relatively recently in the history of aspherical astrophysical objects discovered, that all of the theorists have been bled into other subfields. So there aren't many theorists working in planetary nebulae, asymmetric planetary nebulae. So it's an opportunity for disk jet stuff, as I will explain. So question is, you know, what causes, of course, these jets? And it's largely thought that there are binaries involved. In fact, it's thought that binary now is kind of some influence of binaries. But the most interesting objects, I think, are even, so the planetary nebulae are ionized nebulae, they're ionization nebulae, the pre-planetary nebulae are reflection nebulae. And they are before thought to be, you know, earlier stage. These last maybe 1,000 years. These last maybe 10^4 years. And these are thought to precede these. And the reason that these are interesting is that the power in the jets and momentum in particular is extremely high. It's 1,000 times L over C, luminosity over C. In a sample of objects that is particularly so the best sample is actually still very old, 2001. ALMA is now there are folks working on looking at objects with ALMA. In fact, Raghavendra Sahai does have a measurement recently of another object, but there the sample that is the most interesting is that this Biaro ball 2001 actually molecular outflows 28 of 32 objects that were selected. There's selection effects in how you chose these objects to begin with, so it's not statistics are not good on this, but they have a momentum that's greater than 1,000 times what radiation pressure could supply. And so these outflows, you know, that's already suggesting kind of a jet thing. So what we did is try to constrain the accretion rate. So if you believe that the jets are produced by accretion, and that the systems are binaries, which is pretty reasonable, that there's no evidence that binaries weren't involved. So it doesn't have to be the binary that's presently there. There could have been a binary phase, and that could have spiraled in and such. But if you just take the argument that there's accretion, you can use the momentum to constrain the accretion rate. It's straightforward to do this. You say that, okay, there's a mechanical luminosity first. You start with mechanical luminosity, and that's given by the mass outflow per unit time, which is measured by the age of the object and the total mass that you measure from the observations. The velocity of the jet that you observe, there's the total mass outflow rate, and there's this total mass outflow rate which you can observe. But there's also the jet, so these are actually, the total mechanical luminosity is two ways to think about it. What I've written here is the naked jet outflow rate and the naked jet velocity. So at the very base, let's say before you run into any material, there's a mass outflow rate at the base and there's a velocity at the base. At what you actually observe is something where the material has run into other material. So, but this is the energetics is what happens at the base. This has to be less than the accretion luminosity. And the accretion luminosity can, of course, be written with a Keplerian speed and a given accretion rate. And if you take, for a typical jet launch model, so this is now just jumping to theory, the jet launch speed at the naked jet is some number times the Keplerian speed. And usually this is something between 1 and 5. So this is a kind of standard jet. So you have a constraint on the accretion rate, which has to be greater than the naked jet mass loss times this Q squared. And then to convert this to observational constraints, your accretion rate, which is greater than this, the naked jet is related to the observed jet by momentum conservation in the outflow. So the naked jet is this mass. This is the total mass of the jet divided by the accretion, and that momentum associated with the observed jet is mass that you observe, velocity that you observe, times the characteristic time scale that's associated with the jet. There are different ways of using the observations to get this, but if you just take the age of the, so this is really the acceleration time of the jet, and the age provides an upper limit on that, so thus a lower limit ultimately so it provides a stronger constraint it gives the minimum constraint on the accretion rate if I use the age for this. So you put all this together. These are the observed quantities. This Q is, as I say, a theoretical quantity for the model of a just jet launch from the Keplerian speed. What the ratio is, the Keplerian speed just depends on the mass of your of your accretor. So the accretion rates that you get scale like this appropriately, 10 to the minus 4, for the typical numbers that are being observed in these systems. 10 to the minus 4, and then subject to the particular objects. Now, we then just simply plotted, compared the objects. So if you look, so there's a bunch of different accretion models that produce different accretion rates, Bondi, Hoyle, Wind, Roche overflow that actually we heard about in the talk the other day, and there's also Roche lobe overflow, and there's some constraints on the common envelope accretion rates. So what you can do is make a plot, which I will show in a moment, that shows all of these theoretical accretion rates plotted for the given primary masses and compared to what the observational constraints on the accretion rates are from the momentum. And then I do that for a white dwarf and for a main sequence star. In other words, so if you imagine that the system is a binary, and I have the AGB star, which is now shedding material and accreting onto a companion. The companion can either be a white dwarf.
It's not the AGB star that's accreting. The AGB star is the donor.
Well, there's two ways to think about it. So the first way is that way of thinking about it, that one constraint on the accretion rate could come if the AGB star bleeds its mass onto the companion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the other way of thinking about it is that the core of the AGB star itself, which is a white dwarf, could be the recipient of shredded material that came from a common envelope companion. And that companion, for example, could be a massive planet. So actually, that would put the planets back into planetary nebulae. That's not how they're originally named. But the point of that, so these accretion rate constraints just constrain the jet. They just tell you what of these different mechanisms has to be, and the values that I'll show. That is part of the constraints that come. So it could either be accretion onto a companion, or it could be a shredded low mass object, relative low mass object that spiraled in and itself turned into an accretion disk around the core. Both of those, by the way, are very interesting for further study and have very different potential signatures. For example, if you shred a planet and accrete that onto the central core, then the jet becomes made of planetary material. You might also, and the accretion rates that we'll show for this are onto a white dwarf are extremely high. This is already super Eddington accretion onto white dwarf. So if the accretion is accretion onto a white dwarf, and it's around the planetary core, it's going to be super Eddington accretion onto a white dwarf, which itself, I think there's been very little work on super Eddington accretion onto white dwarfs. So that's a potential.
Is this a super soft X-ray source then, or something like that?
So the thing is, yeah. So let me just first show this. The red rectangle has been modeled actually. So this is one of these objects. This is actually observed to be a binary, which is accreting onto the secondary. It's been really nicely modeled in this paper by Witt et al. and they have different current strain on the accretion rate that comes from the actual just accretion rate needed to maintain line and continuum, and they have, there's an H2 region, and their accretion rate they get is even higher than the accretion rate that comes from the momentum of the outflow. I just wanted to point that out as a moment. But here's the sort of diagram that what the upshot of this sort of is. So if you so what the way to read this diagram is that this is a main sequence star. This is accretion onto a main sequence star. All of these, and the y-axis is the accretion rate, the estimated, the minimum accretion rate that you can have to power these various objects. On the bottom here is this Q. Q is the ratio of the jet speed to the Keplerian speed in the, you know, if you assume that your jet has, and this number is ranging from some, I just, this range is kind of like a theoretical, typical theoretical range that you would expect, just sort of 1 to 5. So the jet being moving faster than the Keplerian speed by factors of 1 to 5. And this is the constraint on the accretion rate. And this is for a white dwarf. So the Eddington luminosity, Eddington accretion rate for a white dwarf is here. And the Eddington accretion rate for a main sequence star is here, of course, higher because the radius is larger, so you don't get as much power out. So if the accretion is onto a main sequence star, it doesn't have to be super Eddington. But it does. But these do rule out, for example, a Bondi-Hoyle accretion. Bondi-Hoyle accretion is just ruled out for these objects. So these objects have to be closer than Bondi-Hoyle. and the red rectangle is basically the Roche-Loeb rate estimated for the red rectangle. and Bondi-Hoyle is Bondi-Hoyle. Wind-Roche-Loeb overflow, that's the model that Philip talked about yesterday, that in this mode of accretion is a mode of accretion whereby the wind of the AGB fills its Roche lobe, but before it gets to the asymptotic acceleration zone. So it can still bleed material, and that's about 50 times the Bondi-Hoyle rate. But this is the kind of thing that one can do. These are only 30 objects right now, but they all have pretty demanding modes. If you, you know, if you want to power these jets, you can't seemingly do it with radiation pressure, and it's back to the same story that motivates, you know, with YSOs, that you needed to find some mechanism of accretion to do that, and so these are the possibilities. So I think, you know, so some of these definitely have accretion onto the secondary, because the red rectangle is observed to have a main sequence companion that's actually accreting. But it's not clear what's going on in a number of these, and I think there are possibly different scenarios that you could imagine. I mean, one question, for example, is can an accretion disk survive in the, if you take a planet shredded around the primary core, can it survive in that primary core without evaporating? For example, which is an interesting question. Also, if there's accretion onto the primary core by a shredded companion, do you see signatures of some kind of novae X-ray emission that you could distill? Of course, it's enshrouded in all this material, so it's hard. But you know, what observational constraints might one put on the various different scenarios? It's just a lot to do for accretion community, I think, in this arena that hasn't really been touched. Maybe I'll just leave it at that, I guess.
Thank you very much.
Sure.